Claudius granted him his liberty, as he did likewise to the other royal captives. They all returned their thanks in a manner the most grateful to the emperor, and as soon as their chains were taken off, walking towards Agrippina, who sat upon a bench at a little distance, they repeated to her the same fervent declarations of gratitude and esteem. The conquest was not achieved without one frightful convulsion of revolt. In this year, A.D. 61, according to Tacitus, a severe disaster was sustained in Britain. Suetonius, the new governor, had engaged himself deeply in the West. He transferred the operational base of the Roman army to Chester. Because it was the centre of Druid resistance, he prepared to attack the populous island of Mona, Anglesey, which had become a refuge for fugitives, and he built a fleet of flat-bottomed vessels suitable for those shallow and shifting seas. The infantry crossed in the boats. The cavalry went over by fords. Where the water was too deep, the men swam alongside their horses. The enemy lined the shore, a dense host of armed men, interspersed with women clad in black like the Furies, with their hair hanging down and holding torches in their hands. Round this were Druids uttering dire curses and stretching their hands towards heaven. These strange sights terrified the soldiers. They stayed motionless, as if paralyzed, offering their bodies to the blows. At last, encouraged by the general, and exhorting each other not to quail before the rabble of female fanatics, they advanced their standards, bore down all resistance, and enveloped the enemy in their own flames. Suetonius imposed a garrison upon the conquered and cut down the groves devoted to their cruel superstitions. For it was part of their religion to spill the blood of captives on their altars and to inquire of the gods by means of human entrails. This dramatic scene on the frontiers of modern Wales was the prelude to a tragedy. The king of the East Anglian Iceni had died. Hoping to save his kingdom and family from molestation, he had appointed Nero, who succeeded Claudius as emperor, as heir jointly with his two daughters. But, says Tacitus, things turned out differently. His kingdom was plundered by centurions, and his private property by slaves, as if they'd been captured in war. His widow, Boadicea, relished by the learned as Boudica, was flogged, and his daughters outraged. The chiefs of the Iceni were robbed of their ancestral properties, as if the Romans had received the whole country as a gift, and the king's own relatives were reduced to slavery. Thus, the Roman historian. Boadicea's tribe, at once the most powerful and hitherto the most submissive, was moved to frenzy against the Roman invaders. They flew to arms. Boadicea found herself at the head of a numerous army, and nearly all the Britons within reach rallied to her standard. There followed an uprush of hatred from the abyss, which is a measure of the cruelty of the conquest. It was a scream of rage against invincible oppression and the superior culture which seemed to lend it power. "Boadicea," said Ranke, "is earnest, rugged, and terrible." Her monument on the Thames embankment opposite Big Ben reminds us of the harsh cry of "Liberty or Death," which has echoed down the ages. In all Britain there were only 4 legions, at most 20,000 men. The 14th and 20th were with Suetonius on his Welsh campaign. The 9th was at Lincoln, and the 2nd at Gloucester. The first target of the revolt was Camulodunum, Colchester, the centre of Roman authority and Roman religion, where the recently settled veterans, supported by the soldiery, who hoped for similar licence for themselves, had been ejecting the inhabitants from their houses and driving them away from their lands. The Britons were encouraged by omens. The statue of victory fell face foremost, as if flying from the enemy. The sea turned red. Strange cries were heard in the council chamber and the theatre. The Roman officials, businessmen, bankers, usurers, and the Britons who'd participated in their authority and profits found themselves with a handful of old soldiers in the midst of a multitude of barbarians. Suetonius was a month distant. The 9th Legion was 120 miles away. There was neither mercy nor hope. The town was burned to ashes. The temple, whose strong walls resisted the conflagration, held out for 2 days. Everyone, Roman or Romanized, was massacred and everything destroyed. Meanwhile, the 9th Legion was marching to the rescue. The victorious Britons advanced from the sack of Colchester to meet it. By sheer force of numbers, they overcame the Roman infantry and slaughtered them to a man, and the commander, Petilius Cerealis, was content to escape with his cavalry. Such were the tidings which reached Suetonius in Anglesey. He realized at once that his army could not make the distance in time to prevent even greater disaster, but, says Tacitus, he undaunted made his way through a hostile country to Londinium, a town which, though not dignified by the title of colony, was a busy emporium for traders. This is the first mention of London in literature. Though fragments of Gallic or Italian pottery, which may or may not antedate the Roman conquest, have been found there, it is certain that the place attained no prominence until the Claudian invaders brought a mass of army contractors and officials to the most convenient bridgehead on the Thames. Suetonius reached London with only a small mounted escort. He'd sent orders to the 2nd Legion to meet him there from Gloucester, but the commander, appalled by the defeat of the 9th, had not complied. London was a large, undefended town, full of Roman traders and their British associates, dependents and slaves. It contained a fortified military depot with valuable stores and a handful of legionaries. The citizens of London implored Suetonius to protect them, but when he heard that Boadicea, having chased Cerealis towards Lincoln, had turned and was marching south, he took the hard but right decision to leave them to their fate. The commander of the 2nd Legion had disobeyed him, and he had no force to withstand the enormous masses hastening towards him. His only course was to rejoin the 14th and 20th Legions, who were marching with might and main from Wales to London along the line of the Roman road now known as Watling Street, and, unmoved by the entreaties of the inhabitants, he gave the signal to march, receiving within his lines all who wished to go with him. The slaughter which fell upon London was universal. No one was spared, neither man, woman, nor child. The wrath of the revolt concentrated itself upon all those of British blood who lent themselves to the wiles and seductions of the invader. In recent times, with London buildings growing taller and needing deeper foundations, the power-driven excavating machines have encountered at many points the layer of ashes which marks the effacement of London at the hands of the natives of Britain. Boadicea then turned upon Verulamium, St. Albans. Here was another trading centre to which high civic rank had been accorded. A like total slaughter and obliteration was inflicted. No less, according to Tacitus, than 70,000 citizens and allies were slain in these three cities. For the barbarians would have no capturing, no selling, nor any kind of traffic usual in war. They would have nothing but killing, by sword, cross, gibbet, or fire. These grim words show us an inexpiable war, like that waged between Carthage and her revolted mercenaries 3 centuries before. Some high modern authorities think these numbers are exaggerated. But there's no reason why London should not have contained 30,000 or 40,000 inhabitants, and Colchester and St. Albans between them about an equal number. If the butcheries in the countryside are added, the estimate of Tacitus may well stand. This is probably the most horrible episode which our island has known. We see the crude and corrupt beginnings of a higher civilization blotted out by the ferocious uprising of the native tribes. Still, it is the primary right of men to die and kill for the land they live in, and to punish, with exceptional severity, all members of their own race who have warmed their hands at the invader's hearth. And now Suetonius, having with him the 14th Legion with the veterans of the 20th, and the auxiliaries nearest at hand, making up a force of about 10,000 fully armed men, resolved for battle. Selecting a position in a defile close in behind a wood, and having made sure that there was no enemy but in front, where there was an open flat unsuited for ambuscades, he drew up his legions in close order, with the light-armed troops on the flanks, while the cavalry was massed at the extremities of the wings. The day was bloody and decisive. The barbarian army, 80,000 strong, attended, like the Germans and the Gauls, by their women and children in an unwieldy wagon train, drew out their array, resolved to conquer or perish. Here was no thought of subsequent accommodation. On both sides, it was all for all. At heavy adverse odds, Roman discipline and tactical skill triumphed. No quarter was given, even to the women. It was a glorious victory, fit to rank with those of the olden days. Some say that little less than 80,000 Britons fell, our own killed being about 400, with a somewhat larger number wounded. These are the tales of the victors. Boadicea poisoned herself. The camp commander of the 2nd Legion, who had both disobeyed his general and deprived his men of their share in the victory, on hearing of the success of the 14th and 20th, fell upon his sword. Suetonius now thought only of vengeance, and indeed there was much to repay. Reinforcements of 4,000 or 5,000 men were sent by Nero from Germany, and all hostile or suspect tribes were harried with fire and sword. Worst of all was the want of food, for in their confident expectation of capturing supplies of the Romans, the Britons had brought every available man into the field and left their land unsown. Yet even so, their spirit was unbroken, and the extermination of the entire ancient British race might have followed, but for the remonstrances of a new procurator, supported by his treasury seniors in Rome, who saw themselves about to be possessed of a desert instead of a province. As a man of action, Suetonius ranks high, and his military decisions were sound. But there was a critical faculty alive in the Roman state which cannot be discounted as arising merely through the jealousies of important people. It was held that Suetonius had been rashly ambitious of military glory, and had been caught unaware by the widespread uprising of the province, that his reverses were due to his own folly, his successes to good fortune, and that a governor must be sent, free from feelings of hostility or triumph, who would deal gently with our conquered enemies. The procurator, Julius Classicianus, whose tombstone is now in the British Museum, kept writing in this sense to Rome, and pleaded vehemently for the pacification of the warrior bands, who still fought on without seeking truce or mercy, starving and perishing in the forests and the fens. In the end, it was resolved to make the best of the Britons. German unrest and dangers from across the Rhine made even military circles in Rome disinclined to squander forces in remoter regions. The loss in a storm of some of Suetonius's warships was made the pretext and occasion of his supersession. The Emperor Nero sent a new governor, who made a peace with the desperate tribesmen, which enabled their blood to be perpetuated in the island race. Tacitus gives an interesting account of the new province. "The red hair and large limbs of the inhabitants of Caledonia," he says, "pointed quite clearly to a German origin, while the dark complexion of the Silures, their usually curly hair, and the fact that Spain lies opposite to them, are evidence that Iberians of a former date crossed over and occupied these parts. Those who are nearest to the Gauls are also like them, either from the permanent influence of original descent, or because climate had produced similar qualities. The religious beliefs of Gaul may be traced in the strongly marked British superstition, Druidism. The language differs but little. There is the same boldness in challenging danger, and when it is near, the same timidity in shrinking from it. The Britons, however, exhibit more spirit, being a people whom a long peace has not yet enervated. Their sky is obscured by continual rain and cloud. Severity of cold is unknown. The days exceed in length those of our world. The nights are bright, and in the extreme north, so short that between sunset and dawn there is but little distinction. With the exception of the olive and vine, and plants which usually grow in warmer climates, the soil will yield all ordinary produce in plenty. It ripens slowly, but grows rapidly, the cause in each case being excessive moisture of soil and atmosphere." In AD 78, Agricola, a governor of talent and energy, was sent to Britannia. Instead of spending his first year of office in the customary tour of ceremony, he took field against all who still disputed the Roman authority. One large tribe, which had massacred a squadron of auxiliary cavalry, was exterminated. The island of Mona, from which Suetonius had been recalled by the rising of Boadicea, was subjugated. With military ability, Agricola united a statesmanlike humanity. According to Tacitus, who'd married his daughter, he proclaimed that little is gained by conquest if followed by oppression. He mitigated the severity of the corn tribute. He encouraged and aided the building of temples, courts of justice, and dwelling houses. He provided a liberal education for the sons of the chiefs, and showed such a preference for the natural powers of the Britons over the more laboured style of the Gauls, that the well-to-do classes were conciliated, and became willing to adopt the toga and other Roman fashions. Step by step, they were led to practices which disposed to vice. The lounge, the bath, the elegant banquet. All this in their ignorance they called civilization, when it was but part of their servitude. Although in the Senate and governing circles in Rome it was constantly explained that the imperial policy adhered to the principle of the great Augustus, that the frontier should be maintained but not extended, Agricola was permitted to conduct 6 campaigns of expansion in Britannia. In the third, he reached the Tyne, the advances of his legions being supported at every stage by a fleet of seaborne supplies. In the fifth campaign, he reached the line of the Forth and Clyde, and here, on this wasp waste of Britain, he might well have dug himself in. But there was no safety or permanent peace for the British province unless he could subdue the powerful tribes and large bands of desperate warriors who'd been driven northwards by his advance. Indeed, it is evident that he would never of his own will have stopped in any direction short of the ocean shore. Therefore, in his sixth campaign, he marched northwards again with all his forces. The position had now become formidable. Past misfortunes had taught the Britons the penalties of disunion. Agricola's son-in-law tells us, "Our army, elated by the glory they had won, exclaimed that they must penetrate the recesses of Caledonia, and at length, in an unbroken succession of battles, discover the farthest limits of Britain. But the Britons, thinking themselves baffled, not so much by our valour as by our general's skilful use of an opportunity, abated nothing of their arrogance, arming their youth, removing their wives and children to a place of safety, and assembling together to ratify, with sacred rites, a confederacy of all their states." The decisive battle was fought in AD 83 at Mons Graupius, a place unidentified, though some suggest the pass of Killiecrankie. Tacitus describes in unconvincing detail the course of this famous struggle. "The whole of Caledonia, all that was left of Britannia, a vast host of broken hunted men resolved on death or freedom, confronted in their superiority of 4 or 5 to 1, the skilfully handled Roman legions and auxiliaries, among whom, no doubt, many British renegades were serving." It is certain that Tacitus greatly exaggerated the dimensions of the native army in these wilds, where they could have no prepared magazines. The number, though still considerable, must have been severely limited. Apparently, as in so many ancient battles, the beaten side were the victims of misunderstanding, and the fate of the day was decided against them before the bulk of the forces realized that a serious engagement had begun. Reserves descended from the hills too late to achieve victory, but in good time to be massacred in the rout. The last organized resistance of Britain to the Roman power ended at Mons Graupius. Here, according to the Roman account, 10,000 of the enemy were slain, and on our side there were about 360 men. Clive's victory at Plassey, which secured for the British Empire a long spell of authority in India, was gained against greater odds, with smaller forces and with smaller losses. The way to the entire subjugation of the island was now open, and had Agricola been encouraged, or at least supported by the imperial government, the course of history might have been altered. But Caledonia was to Rome only a sensation. The real strain was between the Rhine and the Danube. Councils of prudence prevailed, and the remnants of the British fighting men were left to moulder in the northern mists. Dio Cassius, writing over a century later, describes how they were a perpetual source of expense and worry to the settled regions of the south. There are two very extensive tribes in Britain, the Caledonians and the Maetae. The Maetae dwell close up to the cross wall, which cuts the island in two, the Caledonians beyond them. Both live on wild, waterless hills, or forlorn and swampy plains, without walls or towns or husbandry, subsisting on pastoral products and the nuts which they gather. They have fish in plenty, but do not eat it. They live in huts, go naked and unshod, make no separate marriages, and rear all their offspring. They mostly have a democratic government and are much addicted to robbery. They can bear hunger and cold and all manner of hardship. They will retire into their marshes and hold out for days with only their heads above water. And in the forest, they will subsist on bark and roots. In the wild north and west, freedom found refuge among the mountains. But elsewhere, the conquest and pacification were at length complete, and Britannia became one of the 45 provinces of the Roman Empire. The great Augustus had proclaimed as the imperial ideal the creation of a commonwealth of self-governing cantons. Each province was organized as a separate unit, and within it, municipalities received their charters and rights. The provinces were divided between those exposed to barbarian invasion or uprising, for which an imperial garrison must be provided, and those which required no such protection. The military provinces were under the direct supervision of the emperor. The more sheltered were controlled, at least in form, through the medium of the Senate. But in all provinces, the principle was followed of adapting the form of government to local conditions. No prejudice of race, language, or religion obstructed the universal character of the Roman system. The only divisions were those of class, and these ran unchallenged throughout the ordered world. There were Roman citizens, there was an enormous mass of non-Roman citizens, and there were slaves. But movement to full citizenship was possible to fortunate members of the servile class. On this basis, therefore, the life of Britain now developed. Chapter 3. The Roman Province. For nearly 300 years, Britain, reconciled to the Roman system, enjoyed in many respects the happiest, most comfortable, and most enlightened times its inhabitants have had. Confronted with the dangers of the frontiers, the military force was moderate. The wall was held by the auxiliaries, with a legion in support at York. Wales was pinned down by a legion at Chester, and another at Caerleon-on-Usk. In all, the army of occupation numbered less than 40,000 men, and after a few generations was locally recruited and almost of purely British birth. In this period, almost equal to that which separates us from the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, well-to-do persons in Britain lived better than they ever did until late Victorian times. From the year 400 till the year 1900, no one had central heating, and very few had hot baths. A wealthy British Roman citizen building a country house regarded the hypocaust which warmed it as indispensable. For 1,500 years, his descendants lived in the cold of unheated dwellings, mitigated by occasional roastings at gigantic, wasteful fires. Even now, a smaller proportion of the whole population dwells in centrally heated houses than in those ancient days. As for baths, they were completely lost till the middle of the 19th century. In all this long, bleak, intervening gap, cold and dirt clung to the most fortunate and highest in the land. In culture and learning, Britain was a pale reflection of the Roman scene, not so lively as the Gallic. But there was law, there was order, there was peace, there was warmth, there was food, and a long-established custom of life. The population was free from barbarism without being sunk in sloth or luxury. Some culture spread even to the villages. Roman habits percolated. The use of Roman utensils and even of Roman speech steadily grew. The British thought themselves as good Romans as any. Indeed, it may be said that of all the provinces, few assimilated the Roman system with more aptitude than the islanders. The British legionaries and auxiliaries were rated equal or second only to the Illyrians as the finest troops in the empire. There was a sense of pride in sharing in so noble and widespread a system. To be a citizen of Rome was to be a citizen of the world, raised upon a pedestal of unquestioned superiority above barbarians or slaves. Movement across the great empire was as rapid as when Queen Victoria came to the throne, and no obstruction of frontiers, laws, currency, or nationalism hindered it. There's a monument at Norwich, erected to his wife by a Syrian resident in Britain. Constantius Chlorus died at York. British sentinels watched along the Rhine, the Danube, and the Euphrates. Troops from Asia Minor, peering through the mists at the Scottish raiders, preserved the worship of Mithras along the Roman Wall. The cult of this Persian sun god spread widely throughout the Roman world, appealing especially to soldiers, merchants, and administrators. During the 3rd century, Mithraism was a powerful rival to Christianity, and, as was revealed by the impressive temple discovered at Walbrook in 1954, it could count many believers in Roman London. The violent changes at the summit of the empire did not affect so much as might be supposed the ordinary life of its population. Here and there were wars and risings. Rival emperors suppressed each other. Legions mutinied. Usurpers established themselves in the provinces affected on these occasions. The British took a keen interest in the politics of the Roman world and formed strong views upon the changes in the imperial power or upon the morale of the capital. Many thrusting spirits shot forward in Britain to play a part in the deadly game of imperial politics with its unparalleled prizes and fatal forfeits. But all were entirely reconciled to the Roman idea. They had their law, they had their life, which flowed on broad, and, if momentarily disturbed, in the main unaltered. A poll in the 4th century would have declared for an indefinite continuance of the Roman regime. In our own fevered, changing and precarious age, where all is in flux and nothing is accepted, we must survey with respect a period when, with only 300,000 soldiers, widespread peace in the entire known world was maintained from generation to generation, and when the first pristine impulse of Christianity lifted men's souls to the contemplation of new and larger harmonies beyond the ordered world around them. The gift which Roman civilization had to bestow was civic and political. Towns were planned in chessboard squares for communities dwelling under orderly government. The buildings rose in accordance with the pattern standardized throughout the Roman world. Each was complete with its forums, temples, courts of justice, jails, baths, markets, and main drains. During the 1st century, the builders evidently took a sanguine view of the resources and future of Britannia, and all their towns were projected to meet an increasing population. It was a period of hope. The experts dispute the population of Roman Britain, and rival estimates vary between 500,000 and 1.5 million. It seems certain that the army, the civil services, the townsfolk, the well-to-do, and their dependents amounted to 300,000 or 400,000. To grow food for these, under the agricultural methods of the age, would have required on the land perhaps double their number. We may therefore assume a population of at least 1 million in the Romanized area. There may well have been more. But there are no signs that any large increase of population accompanied the Roman system. In more than 2 centuries of peace and order, the inhabitants remained at about the same numbers as in the days of Cassivellaunus. This failure to foster and support a more numerous life spread disappointment and contraction throughout Roman Britain. The conquerors, who so easily subdued and rallied the Britons to their method of social life, brought with them no means, apart from stopping tribal war, of increasing the annual income derived from the productivity of the soil. The new society, with all its grace of structure, with its spice of elegance and luxury, Baths, banquets, togas, schools, literature and oratory stood on no more sumptuous foundation than the agriculture of prehistoric times. The rude plenty in which the ancient Britons had dwelt was capable of supporting only to a moderate extent the imposing facade of Roman life. The cultivated ground was still for the most part confined to the lighter and more easily cultivated upland soils, which had for thousands of years been worked in a primitive fashion. The powerful Gallic plough on wheels was known in Britain, but it did not supplant the native implement, which could only nose along in shallow furrows. With a few exceptions, there was no large-scale attempt to clear the forests, drain the marshes, and cultivate the heavy clay soils of the valleys in which so much fertility had been deposited. Such mining of lead and tin, such smelting as had existed from times immemorial, may have gained something from orderly administration. But there was no new science, no new thrust of power and knowledge in the material sphere. Thus, the economic basis remained constant, and Britain became more genteel rather than more wealthy. The life of Britain continued upon a small scale, and in the main was stationary. The new edifice, so stately and admirable, was light and frail. These conditions soon cast their shadows upon the boldly planned towns. The surrounding agricultural prosperity was not sufficient to support the hopes of their designers. There are several excavations which show that the original boundaries were never occupied, or that, having been at first occupied, portions of the town fell gradually into decay. There was not enough material well-being to make things go. Nevertheless, men dwelt safely, and what property they had was secured by iron laws. Urban life in Britain was a failure not of existence, but of expansion. It ran on like the life of some cathedral city, some fading provincial town, sedate, restricted, even contracting, but not without grace and dignity. We owe London to Rome. The military engineers of Claudius, the bureaucracy which directed the supply of the armies, the merchants who followed in their wake, brought it into a life not yet stilled. Trade followed the development of their road system. An extensive and well-planned city with mighty walls took the place of the wooden trading settlement of AD 61, and soon achieved a leading place in the life of the Roman province of Britain, superseding the old Belgic capital, Colchester, as the commercial centre. At the end of the 3rd century, money was coined in the London Mint, and the city was the headquarters of the financial administration. In the later days of the province, London seems to have been the centre of civil government, as York was of the military, although it never received the status of a municipium. The efflorescence of Roman Britain was found in its villa population all over the settled area. The villas of country gentlemen of modest station were built in the most delightful spots of a virgin countryside, amid primeval forests and the gushing of untamed streams. A very large number of comfortable dwellings, each with its lands around it, rose and thrived. At least 500 have been explored in the southern counties. None is found farther north than Yorkshire, or farther west than the Glamorgan seaplain. The comparative unsuccess of urban life led the better-class Roman Britons to establish themselves in the country, and thus the villa system was the dominant feature of Roman Britain in its heyday. The villas retained their prosperity after the towns had already decayed. The towns were shrunken after the 3rd century. The villas still flourished in the 4th, and in some cases lingered on into the darkening days of the 5th. The need for strong defences at the time when the expansion of the empire had practically reached its limits was met by the frontier policy of the Flavian emperors. Domitian was the first to build a continuous line of fortifications. About AD 89, the great earth rampart was constructed on the Black Sea, and another connecting the Rhine with the Danube. By the end of the 1st century, a standard type of frontier barrier had been evolved. The work of Agricola in northern Britain had been left unfinished at his hasty recall. No satisfactory line of defence had been erected, and the position which he'd won in Scotland had to be gradually abandoned. The legions fell back on the line of the Staingate, a road running eastwards from Carlisle. The years which followed revealed the weakness of the British frontier. The accession of Hadrian was marked by a serious disaster. The 9th Legion disappears from history in combating an obscure rising of the tribes in northern Britain. The defences were disorganised and the province was in danger. Hadrian came himself to Britain in 122, and the reorganisation of the frontier began. During the next 5 years, a military barrier was built between the Tyne and the Solway, 73 miles long. It consisted of a stone rampart 8 to 10 feet thick, sustained by 17 forts, each garrisoned by an auxiliary cohort, about 80 castles, and double that number of signal towers. In front of the wall was a 30-foot ditch, and behind it, another ditch which seems to have been designed as a customs frontier, and was probably controlled and staffed by the financial administration. The works needed a supporting garrison of about 14,000 men, not including some 5,000 who, independent of the fighting units in the forts, were engaged in patrol work along the wall. The troops were provisioned by the local population, whose taxes were paid in wheat, and each fort contained granaries capable of holding a year's supply of food. 20 years later, in the reign of the Emperor Antoninus Pius, the Roman troops pushed northwards again over the ground of Agricola's conquests, and a new wall was built across the Forth Clyde Isthmus, 37 miles in length. The object was to control the tribes of the eastern and central lowlands, but the Roman forces in Britain were not able to man the new defences without weakening their position on Hadrian's Wall and in the west. The middle years of the 2nd century were troubled in the military area. Somewhere about the year 186, the Antonine Wall was abandoned and the troops were concentrated on the original line of defence. Tribal revolts and Scottish raids continually assailed the northern frontier system, and in places the wall and its supporting camps were utterly wrecked. It was not until the Emperor Severus came to Britain in 208 and flung his energies into the task of reorganisation that stability was achieved. So great had been the destruction, so massive were his repairs, that in later times he was thought to have built the wall, which in fact he only reconstructed. He died at York in 211, but for 100 years there was peace along the Roman Wall. We can measure the Roman activity in road building by the milestones which are discovered from time to time, recording the name of the emperor under whose decree the work was done. These long, unswerving causeways stretched in bold lines across the island. Ordinarily, the road was made with a bottoming of large stones, often embedded in sand, covered with a surface of rammed gravel, the whole on an average 18 inches thick. In special cases, or after much repairing, the formation extended to a 3-foot thickness. Over Blackstone Edge, where the road was laid upon peat, a 16-foot road span was made of squared blocks of millstone grit, with a curb on either side and a line of large square stones down the middle. Upon these, the wheels of ancient carts going down the steep hill, braked by skid pans, have made their grooves. The first half-century after the Claudian invasion was very active in road-building. In the 2nd century, we find most of the work concentrated upon the frontiers of the military districts. By the 3rd century, the road system was complete and needed only to be kept in repair. It is true that for the period of Constantine the Great, no fewer than 4 milestones have been unearthed, which point to some fresh extension. But by 340, all new work was ended, and though repairs were carried out as long as possible, no later milestones proclaim a forward movement. The same symptoms reproduced themselves in Gaul after the year 350. These pedestrian facts are one measure of the rise and decline of the Roman power. If a native of Chester in Roman Britain could wake up today, he would find laws which were the direct fulfilment of many of those he'd known. He would find in every village temples and priests of the new creed, which in his day was winning victories everywhere. Indeed, the facilities for Christian worship would appear to him to be far in excess of the number of devotees. Not without pride would he notice that his children were compelled to learn Latin if they wished to enter the most famous universities. He might encounter some serious difficulties in the pronunciation. He would find in the public libraries many of the masterpieces of ancient literature, printed on uncommonly cheap paper and in great numbers. He would find a settled government and a sense of belonging to a worldwide empire. He could drink and bathe in the waters of Bath, or if this were too far, he would find vapour baths and toilet conveniences in every city. He would find all his own problems of currency, land tenure, public morals and decorum presented in a somewhat different aspect, but still in lively dispute. He would have the same sense of belonging to a society which was threatened and to an imperial rule which had passed its prime. He would have the same gathering fears of some sudden onslaught by barbarian forces armed with equal weapons to those of the local legions or auxiliaries. He would still fear the people across the North Sea, and still be taught that his frontiers were upon the Rhine. The most marked changes that would confront him would be the speed of communications and the volume of printed and broadcast matter. He might find both distressing. But against these, he could set chloroform, antiseptics, and a more scientific knowledge of hygiene. He would have longer history books to read, containing worse tales than those of Tacitus and Dio. Facilities would be afforded to him for seeing regions Caesar never knew, from which he would probably return in sorrow and wonder. He would find himself hampered in every aspect of foreign travel, except that of speed. If he wished to journey to Rome, Constantinople, or Jerusalem, otherwise than by sea, a dozen frontiers would scrutinize his entry. He would be called upon to develop a large number of tribal and racial enmities to which he had formerly been a stranger. But the more he studied the accounts of what had happened since the 3rd century, the more satisfied he would be not to have been awakened at an earlier time. Carefully conserved, the resources of the empire in men and material were probably sufficient to maintain the frontiers intact. But they were often wasted in war between rival emperors, and by the middle of the 3rd century, the empire was politically in a state of chaos and financially ruined. Yet there was much vitality still, and from the Illyrian armies came a succession of great soldiers and administrators to restore the unity of the empire and consolidate its defences. By the end of the century, Rome seemed as powerful and stable as ever. But below the surface, the foundations were cracking, and through the fissures, new ideas and new institutions were thrusting themselves. The cities are everywhere in decline. Trade, industry, and agriculture bend under the weight of taxation. Communications are less safe, and some provinces are infested with marauders, peasants who can no longer earn a living on the land. The empire is gradually dissolving into units of a kind unknown to classical antiquity, which will someday be brought together in a new pattern, feudal and Christian. But before that can happen, generations must pass, while the new absolutism struggles by main force to keep the roads open, the fields in cultivation, and the barbarian at bay. Nevertheless, the Roman Empire was an old system. Its sinews and arteries had borne the strain of all that the ancient world had endured. The Roman world, like an aged man, wished to dwell in peace and tranquillity, and to enjoy in philosophic detachment the good gifts which life has to bestow upon the more fortunate classes. But new ideas disturbed the internal conservatism, and outside the carefully guarded frontiers, vast masses of hungry, savage men surged and schemed. The essence of the Roman peace was toleration of all religions and the acceptance of a universal system of government. Every generation after the middle of the 2nd century saw an increasing weakening of the system and a gathering movement towards a uniform religion. Christianity asked again all the questions which the Roman world deemed answered forever, and some that it had never thought of. Although the varieties of status, with all their grievous consequences, were accepted during these centuries, even by those who suffered from them most, as part of the law of nature, the institution of slavery, by which a third of Roman society was bound, could not withstand indefinitely the new dynamic thoughts which Christianity brought with it. The alternations between fanatic profligacy and avenging Puritanism, which marked the succession of the emperors, the contrast between the morals at the centre of power and those practised by wide communities in many subject lands, presented problems of ever-growing unrest. At the moment when mankind seemed to have solved a very large proportion of its secular difficulties, and when a supreme government offered unlimited freedom to spiritual experiment, inexorable forces both within and without drove on the forward march. No rest, no stay. For here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come. Strange standards of destiny were unfurled, destructive of peace and order, but thrilling the hearts of men. Before the Roman system lay troubles immeasurable, squalor, slaughter, chaos itself, and the long night which was to fall upon the world. From outside, the uncouth barbarians smote upon the barriers. Here on the mainland were savage fighting animals, joined together in comradeship of arms, with the best fighting men and their progeny as leaders. In the rough and tumble of these communities, with all their crimes and bestialities, there was a more active principle of life than in the majestic achievements of the Roman Empire. We see these forces swelling like a flood against all the threatened dikes of the Roman world, not only brimming at the lip of the dam, but percolating insidiously, now by a breach, now in a mere ooze, while all the time men become conscious of the frailty of the structure itself. Floods of new untamed life burst ceaselessly from Asia, driving westward in a succession of waves. Against these, there was no easy superiority of weapons. Cold steel and discipline, and the slight capital surplus necessary to move and organize armies, constituted the sole defenses. If the superior virtue of the legion failed, all fell. Certainly, from the middle of the second century, all these disruptive forces were plainly manifest. However, in Roman Britain, men thought for many generations that they'd answered the riddle of the Sphinx. They misconceived the meaning of her smile. Chapter 4. The Lost Island. No one can understand history without continually relating the long periods which are constantly mentioned to the experiences of our own short lives. 5 years is a lot. 20 years is the horizon to most people. 50 years is antiquity. To understand how the impact of destiny fell upon any generation of men, one must first imagine their position and then apply the timescale of our own lives. Thus, nearly all the changes were far less perceptible to those who lived through them from day to day than appears when the salient features of an epoch are extracted by the chronicler. We peer at these scenes through dim telescopes of research across a gulf of nearly 2,000 years. We cannot doubt that the second and to some extent the third centuries of the Christian era, in contrast with all that had gone before and most that was to follow, were a golden age for Britain. But by the early part of the fourth century, shadows had fallen upon this imperfect yet nonetheless tolerable society. By steady, persistent steps, the sense of security departed from Roman Britain. Its citizens felt by daily experience a sense that the worldwide system of which they formed a partner province was in decline. They entered a period of alarm. The spade of the archaeologist, correcting and enlarging the study of historians, the discovery and scrutiny of excavations, ruins, stones, inscriptions, coins and skeletons, the new yields of aerial photography, are telling a tale which none can doubt. Although the main impressions of the 19th century are not overthrown, modern knowledge has become more true, more precise, and more profound. The emphasis placed by Victorian writers upon causes and events and their chronology has been altered, especially since the First World War. Their dramas have been modified or upset. A host of solid gradations and sharp-cut refinements is being marshalled in stubborn array. We walk with shorter paces, but on firmer footholds. Famous books, which their writers, after a lifetime's toil, believed were final, are now recognized as already obsolete, and new conclusions are drawn not so much from new standpoints as from new discoveries. Nevertheless, the broad story holds, for it is founded in a dominating simplicity. From the end of the 3rd century, when Roman civilization in Britain and the challenge to the supreme structure were equally at their height, inroads of barbarian peoples began, both from Europe and from the forlorn island to the westward. The Scots, whom nowadays we shall call the Irish, and the Picts from Scotland, began to press on Hadrian's Wall, to turn both flanks of it by sea raids on a growing scale. At the same time, the Saxons rowed in longboats across the North Sea and lay heavy all along the east coast from Newcastle to Dover. From this time forth, the British countryside dwelt under the same kind of menace of cruel, bloody, and sudden inroad from the sea as do modern nations from the air. Many proofs have been drawn from the soil in recent years. All point to the same conclusion. The villa life of Britain, upon which the edifice of Roman occupation was now built, was in jeopardy. We see the signs of fear spreading through the whole country. Besides the forts along the east and south coasts, and the system of galleys based upon them, a host of new precautions become evident. The walls of London were furnished with bastion towers, the stones for which were taken from dwelling houses, now no longer required by a dwindling town population. Here and there, the broad Roman gateways of townships were narrowed to half their size with masonry, a lasting proof of the increasing insecurity of the times. All over the country, hoards of coins have been found, hardly any of which are later than the year AD 400. Over this fertile, peaceful, ordered world lay the apprehension of constant peril. Like other systems in decay, the Roman Empire continued to function for several generations after its vitality was sapped. For nearly 100 years, our island was one of the scenes of conflict between a dying civilization and lusty, famishing barbarism. Up to the year 300, Hadrian's Wall, with its garrisons, barred out the northern savages. But thereafter, a new front must be added. At the side of the Duke of the Northern Marches, there must stand the Count of the Saxon Shore. All round the eastern and southern coasts, from the Wash to Southampton Water, a line of large fortresses was laboriously built. 8 have been examined. Of these, the chief was Richborough, known to the generation of the First World War as an invaluable ferry port for the supply of the armies in France. There is some dispute about the strategic conceptions upon which these strongholds were called into being. Many disparaging judgments have been passed upon the policy which is accused of seeking to protect 400 miles of coastline from these 8 points. Obviously, these strictures are unjust. The new line of coastal fortresses could only have had any value or reason as bases for a British-Roman fleet. Such a fleet, the Classis Britannica, had been maintained from the 1st century. Tiles with an Admiralty mark show that it had permanent stations at Dover and Lynn. But the whole coast was organized for defense, and for long periods these measures proved effective. Wigatius, writing in the 4th century on the art of war, mentions a special kind of light galley attached to the British fleet. These vessels, the hulls, sails, the men's clothes, and even faces, were painted sea green to make them invisible. And Wigatius tells us that in naval parlance they were called the Painted Ones. As the Imperial and British sea power gradually became unequal to the raiders, the ramparts of the fortresses grew higher, and their usefulness less. Flotilla defense by oared galleys working from bases 50 to 100 miles apart could not contend indefinitely with raiding thrusts. Even a high sea fleet, capable of keeping the sea for months at a time off the coasts of what are now called Holland, Germany, and Denmark, though a powerful deterrent, would have been too slow to deal with oared boats in calm weather. The Roman Britons were lively and audacious members of the empire. They took a particularist view, yet wished to have a hand in the game themselves. As time passed, the Roman garrison in Britain steadily became more British, and towards the end of the 3rd century it assumed a strong national character. While glorying in the name of citizens and Romans, and having no desire for independence, both province and army adopted a highly critical attitude towards the imperial government. Emperors who disregarded British opinion, or sacrificed British interests, above all those who could be accused of neglecting the defences of the province, were the objects of active resentment. A series of mutinies and revolts aggravated the growing dangers of the times. No one can suppose that the Roman military centres at Chester, York, or Caerleon on Usk threw up claimants for the imperial diadem, unsupported by a strong backing in local opinion. These were not merely mutinies of discontented soldiers. They were bold bids for control of the Roman Empire by legions only a few thousand strong, but expressing the mood, sentiments, and ambitions of the society in which they lived. They left the local scene for the supreme theatre, like players who wished to quit the provinces for the capital. Unhappily, they took away with them at each stage important elements of the exiguous military forces needed to man the dikes. The Emperor Diocletian has gone down to history principally as the persecutor of the early Christians, and the enormous work which he achieved in restoring the frontiers of the ancient world has remained under that shadow. His policy was to construct a composite Caesarship. There were to be two emperors and two Caesars, he himself being the senior of the four. In due course, the emperors would retire in favour of the Caesars, new ones would be appointed, and thus the succession would be preserved. The co-emperor, Maximian, sent to Gaul in 285 and responsible for Britannia, was deeply concerned by the raiding of the Saxon pirates. He strengthened the Channel fleet and put at its head a naval officer from Belgium named Carausius. This man was tough, resolute, ambitious, and without scruple. From his base at Boulogne, he encouraged the raiders to come and pillage, and then, when they were laden with plunder, he fell upon them with Roman-British flotillas, captured them by scores, and destroyed them without mercy. His success did not satisfy the British community. They accused him of having been in league with those he destroyed. He explained that this was all part of his ambush, but the fact that he'd retained all the spoil in his own hands told heavily against him. Maximian sought to bring him to execution, but Carausius, landing in Britain, declared himself emperor, gained the island garrison to his cause, and defeated Maximian in a sea battle. On this it was thought expedient to come to terms with the stubborn rebel, and in the year 287, Carausius was tacitly recognised as one of the Augusti in command of Britain and of northern Gaul. For 6 years this adventurer, possessing sea power, reigned in our island. He seems to have served its interests passably well. However, the Emperor Diocletian and his colleagues were only biding their time, and in the year 293 they cast away all pretense of friendship. One of the new Caesars, Constantius Chlorus, besieged and took Boulogne, the principal continental base of Carausius, who was soon assassinated by one of his officers. The new competitor sought to become emperor in his stead. He did not gain the support of the British nation, and the whole country fell into confusion. The Picts were not slow to seize their advantage. The wall was pierced, and fire and sword wasted the northern districts. Chlorus crossed the channel as a deliverer. His colleague, with part of the force, landed near Portsmouth. He himself sailed up the Thames and was received by London with gratitude and submission. He restored order. A gold medallion discovered at Arras in 1922 reveals him at the head of the fleet that had sailed up the Thames. He drove back the northern invaders and set to work to restore and improve the whole system of defence. Continuous efforts were made by the Roman-British community to repel the inroads, and for two or three generations there were counterstrokes by flotillas of galleys and hurried marchings of cohorts and of British auxiliaries towards the various thrusts of raid or invasion. But although the process of wearing down was spread over many years, and misery deepened by inches, we must recognise in the year 367 circumstances of supreme and murderous horror. In that fatal year, the Picts, the Scots, and the Saxons seemed to work in combination. All fell together upon Britannia. The imperial troops resisted manfully. The Duke of the Northern Marches and the Count of the Saxon Shore were killed in the battles. A wide-open breach was made in the defences, and murderous hordes poured in upon the fine world of country houses and homesteads. Everywhere they were blotted out. The ruins tell the tale. The splendid Mildenhall silver dinner service, now in the British Museum, is thought to have been buried at this time by its owners when their villa was surprised by raiders. Evidently they did not live to dig it up again. The villa life of Britain only feebly recovered from the disaster. The towns were already declining. Now people took refuge in them. At least they had walls. The pages of history reveal the repeated efforts made by the imperial government to protect Britannia. Again and again, in spite of revolts and ingratitude, officers and troops were sent to restore order or drive back the barbarians. After the disasters of 367, the Emperor Valentinian sent a general, Theodosius, with a considerable force to relieve the province. Theodosius achieved his task, and once again we find on the coastal fortifications the traces of a further strong reconstruction. Untaught, however, by continuing danger, the garrison and inhabitants of Britain in 383 yielded themselves willingly to a Spaniard, Magnus Maximus, who held the command in Britain and now declared himself emperor. Scraping together all the troops he could find, and stripping the wall and the fortresses of their already scanty defenders, Maximus hastened to Gaul and defeated the Emperor Gratian near Paris. Gratian was murdered at Lyon by his troops, and Maximus became master of Gaul and Spain as well as Britain. For 5 years he struggled to defend his claim to these great dominions, but Theodosius, who'd succeeded Gratian, at length defeated and slew him. Meanwhile, the wall was pierced again, and Britain lay open to the raiders both from the north and from the sea. 7 years more were to pass before Theodosius could send his general, Stilicho, who was a Romanized barbarian, to the island. This great soldier drove out the intruders and repaired the defences. The writings of Claudian, the court poet, describe in triumphant terms the liberation of Britain from its Saxon, Pictish, and Scottish assailants in the year 400. In celebrating the first consulship of Stilicho, he tells how Britain has expressed her gratitude for her deliverance from the fear of these foes. This sentiment soon fades. Stilicho had returned to Rome, and was in chief command when in the same year Alaric and the Visigoths invaded Italy. He was forced to recall a further part of the British garrison to defend the heart of the empire. In 402, he defeated Alaric in the great Battle of Pollentia and drove him out of Italy. No sooner was this accomplished than a new barbarian invasion swept down upon him under Radagaisus. By 405, Stilicho had completely destroyed this second vast host. Italy was scarcely clear when a confederacy of Suevi, Vandals, Avars, and Burgundians broke through the Rhine frontiers and overran northern Gaul. The indomitable Stilicho was preparing to meet this onslaught when the British army, complaining that the province was being neglected, mutinied. They set up a rival emperor named Marcus, and on his speedy murder, elected a Briton, Gratianus, in his stead. After his assassination, 4 months later, the soldiers chose another Briton who bore the famous name of Constantine. Constantine, instead of protecting the island, found himself compelled to defend upon the continent the titles he'd usurped. He drained Britain of troops, and as Magnus Maximus had done, set forth for Boulogne to try his fortune. In the supreme theatre for 3 years, with varying success, he contended with Stilicho, and was finally captured and executed, as Maximus had been before him. None of the troops who'd accompanied him ever returned to Britain. Thus, in these fatal years, the civilized parts of the island were stripped of their defenders, both in order to aid the empire and to strike against it. By the beginning of the 5th century, all the legions had gone on one errand or another, and to frantic appeals for aid, the helpless Emperor Honorius could only send his valedictory message in 410 that the cantons should take steps to defend themselves. The first glimpse we have of the British after the Roman government had withdrawn its protection is afforded by the visit of St. Germanus in 429. The bishop came from Auxerre in order to uproot the Pelagian heresy, which, in spite of other preoccupations, our Christian island had been able to evolve. This doctrine consisted in assigning an undue importance to free will and cast a consequential slur upon the doctrine of original sin. It thus threatened to deprive mankind, from its very birth, of an essential part of our inheritance. The bishop of Auxerre and another episcopal colleague arrived at St. Albans, and were assured that they soon convinced the doubters and eradicated the evil opinions to which they had incautiously hearkened. What kind of Britain did he find? He speaks of it as a land of wealth. There is treasure. There are flocks and herds. Food is abundant. Institution, civil and religious, function. The country is prosperous, but at war. An invading army from the north or east is approaching. It was an army said to be composed of Saxons, Picts, and Scots in ill-assorted and unholy alliance. The bishop had been a distinguished general in his prime. He organized the local forces. He reconnoitred the surrounding districts. He noticed in the line of the enemy's advance a valley surrounded by high hills. He took command and lay in ambush for the ferocious heathen hordes. When the enemy were entangled in the defile, suddenly the priests shouted a triple alleluia at their foes. The cry was taken up with one mighty shout and echoed from side to side of the enclosed valley. The enemy were smitten with terror, thinking that the rocks and the very sky were falling upon them. Such was their fear that they could hardly run quickly enough. They threw away their arms in their disorderly flight, glad to escape naked. A river devoured many in their headlong fear, though in their advance they'd crossed in good order. The innocent army saw itself avenged, a spectator of a victory gained without exertion. The abandoned spoils were collected, and the Britons triumphed over an enemy, routed without loss of blood. The victory was won by faith and not by might. So the bishop returned to Auxerre, having settled the affairs of that most wealthy island, and overcome their foes both spiritual and carnal, that is to say, both the Pelagians and the Saxons. Another 12 years passed, and a Gaulish chronicler records this somber note in AD 441 or 442. "The Britons in these days, by all kinds of calamities and disasters, are falling into the power of the Saxons." What had happened? Something more than the forays of the 4th century, the mass migration from North Germany had begun. Thereafter, the darkness closes in. Upon this darkness we have 4 windows, each obstructed by dim or coloured glass. First, we have the tract of Gildas, upon whom the gratitude of the Middle Ages bestowed the title of the Wise. The tract was written in approximately AD 545, and therefore 100 years after the curtain fell between Britannia and the continent. Nearly 200 years later, the Venerable Bede, whose main theme was the history of the English Church, lets fall some precious scraps of information, outside his subject, about the settlement itself. A compilation known as the